Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Bill.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Joe.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go.
My guest, Marlena Graves, is a writer and adjunct professor. Marlena holds an MDiv from Northeastern Seminary in Rochester, New York, and is a graduate of the Renovare Institute. She's been a byline writer for Christianity Today, Encourage, WomenLeaders.com, and Our Daily Bread. She's also the author of A Beautiful Disaster. She lives with her husband and three daughters in Toledo, Ohio. Her new book is called The Way Up is Down, Becoming Yourself by Forgetting Yourself. Marlena, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. It's quite an honor to make it to Seminary Dropout.
Oh, stop it. So I was telling you before the show started, I've been reading your writings for a really long time. You used to be kind of regular writer for Missio Alliance, where this podcast is hosted. I'm curious to know, like, what was the kernel for this book? Like, where did it come from?
Yeah, thank you. I think, you know, a few people have asked me about that. And the more I think about it, I've mentioned this a few times, but really from two things. My first book, A Beautiful Disaster, Finding Hope in the Midst of Brokenness, was with my reflections on God with us in the wilderness. Wilderness, the dark night, and talking about how most my life has been a dark night or wilderness, and but how God has shown up in the wilderness, and that, you know, the ancients talk about that. It's it was to me a modern day theology on suffering and reflection on suffering and how God is with us in that. And this book is, if I think more about it, is like the continuation. Okay, God's with us in our suffering now. How do we live now? And the now part is the other kernel, because prior to the 2016 election, it's been some time now, probably going back, you know, more than eight years, probably a decade that I've been disgusted with evangelical and national politics, but not just that, how the church has been to me not a good witness. The American church. And I mean, if I have to get more specific, I can about the church, because I am not including the Black church and others in that. But the evangelicals that have the mic, even though I'm kind of evangelical adjacent, I never grew up in evangelical culture. I say I always visited it. And but that was not my upbringing. The culture was not my upbringing. And so anyways, I was just felt betrayed by people that I used to listen to on the radio, telling us how to follow Jesus, but who made an about face and, you know, acted like how we act and behave and what we say doesn't matter, and how they were using godless means to get what they believe were God's ends. And I was kind of, you know, just disillusioned, basically. And so I was thinking, you know what, Jesus is not like that. I know he's not. So I wanted to reflect on how Jesus lived, you know, and that's nothing new, of course, but I was really strong. You know, he emptied himself, the self-sacrifice, and he didn't cling to his rights. And it seems like a lot of Christians are, and I want to be careful to say not all, there's plenty of beautiful people. That's not what I mean, but I'm just saying overall, those that have the national mic and the ones that are interviewed in places seem to be grasping and greedy and hungry for power. And of course, there's been cover up of sexual abuse. And I'm like, it's a terrible witness. And so I wanted to look at what are we, including me, not doing that Jesus does. And so that's what the book came from.
I've got so many questions, like follow up questions and thoughts as you're talking. But I think I want to know more about your upbringing. You mentioned you didn't grow up in evangelicalism. I'm really curious about what kind of faith tradition you did grow up in and what that meant to you, and then how you kind of came to interact with evangelicalism.
Yeah. You know, the way I kind of describe it, I forget where it is. Is there a city or town where the four states meet in the Southwest? Was it Colorado, Arizona? I don't remember where, but there's four states that meet there. Yeah. you know, I was born in Puerto Rico, but my Dania, you know, Southern New York, Southwestern New York and Northwestern Pennsylvania, like the northern tip of Appalachia. I didn't know that then. That used to be known for oil, but everyone moved, you know, it's just, and then Walmart came and closed down all the stores. But I didn't know anything else. You know, I lived in Puerto Rico for a little bit. My dad was in the military, met my mom there, and then in California for a little bit when I was younger. And then most of the time I grew up in Northwestern Pennsylvania. And we were the only, like, and I think about the census, we were like the only Latino, Latinas, you know, multiracial, but like spoke Spanish growing up. And people said, I don't have an accent now, but I was always told I had an ass accent. I was asked if I was an African-American, you know, cause I was a lot darker. I always say I'm bleached out now, but, anyways. And so I was very isolated because we grew up in the biggest geographical school district in Pennsylvania, meaning it took the longest to get from, you know, from where I lived to my actual school. I don't know if it was like 17 miles or something. Wow. And at the time when we were young, you know, we lived on the edge of the school district. So we lived on the edge of the school district. So I had long distance and couldn't speak to my friends because we didn't have money to pay for that. And so so isolation was a part of my upbringing, and I would walk to my country church because, as I said, I was baptized as a Roman Catholic, but I had a lot of Protestant influences because my dad was Protestant, my mom was Catholic, and my abuelita, my mom's mom and abuelo would live with us at different times in my life. And I would see how much she read scripture, and that's where I had a love of scripture. In fact, from the ages of about 10 to 14, I read scripture 2 to 4 hours a day after I was done with my chores and everything else. And so now people talk about being formed by the scriptural imagination. I did not have words for that, but that's what happens. And I feel like growing up, I was in a cell, or I basically had a monastic upbringing due to the isolation of where I lived. And maybe the church that was, it was a mile away. I'd walk myself and I'd take my brother and sister. My parents did not go. Abuelita did not go to that church. Of course, she didn't speak a lot of English, nor could she understand a lot of it, but, and abuelo. So I'd go by myself because I so wanted to be, I was hungry for God and, like ravenous for God. And, they took good care of us out there in the country. It was a Methodist church and a Baptist church that didn't have enough members. So they unified into a community church. And so I have no idea what Methodist or Baptist influence I had, cause you know, it's been years. All that to say, my, pastor's daughter ended up going to a conservative Christian university. I had no idea about, denominational distinctives or anything. It was Baptist. I'm like, Christian college, non-Christian. That's my option. I got a full ride to Penn State main campus, which I found out later that you usually don't get a full ride into the main campus. You have to go to a satellite school and then go to the main campus. So that was good, but I wanted to be mentored by Christians. And that's where I ran into like the evangelical culture. And I met the most beautiful people there, but I saw some of the most ugly things there. And then fast forward, went to seminary, read Church Fathers and Mothers and the Eastern Orthodox. So I feel like I'm heavily influenced by the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox tradition. Not evangelical by culture, but I'm evangelical in that Jesus is central. And when I say culture, I'm talking about like, you know, purity culture and the kind of clothes you wear and gender roles. I didn't hear anything about that until I went to this Christian school.
And I would imagine political affiliations as well.
Yeah, yeah. We didn't talk about, like, to be Christian, you have to, I mean, a lot of people were Republicans and stuff, but it wasn't like that was the Christian way.
Yeah. Did you have a moment where, or maybe it was a span of time, where you before thought, I'm going to Christian school to be around Christian people where, I'm going to be accepted as one of them because I'm also a Christian and, you know, things are going to be equitable and good and there's going to be a, embodied justice going on. And then a time where you were, shown that that was not the case.
Yes. I don't know how you nailed that, but like, I was expecting like heaven or something. Cause I'm like, okay, in my other book, I talk about growing up and stuff, but it was difficult for me growing up as very poor. And, there's mental illness in my family. And I thought, oh my gosh, finally I'll like be free of like chaotic things. I mean, I love my parents dearly. I don't mean that my family, I've never been abused or anything like that. So I don't mean to misrepresent them. Love my family to pieces, but they were just trying to find themselves, you know? I was at a Christian school. And then when I was very shocked that, you know, guys and girls like didn't act like Jesus. It's like, what is this? I'm like at a Christian school. And I was like, I was expecting to see people to be very, you know, to use a word that they used to use, on fire for Jesus and, you know, acting like him. But it's a culture. And I didn't realize, you know, I can think about that. And I didn't reflect about how there were certain mores and ways of being and like signal words and certain things that I did not have, in my vocabulary. And for example, I mean, one of the most shocking things I heard was, I remember, you know, they used to do, maybe they still do in churches, these spiritual gifts tests. And mine was like teacher, pastor, prophet, and our pastor, teacher, prophet, something in that order. And there was about 200 people in this, it was called God in the Church class. And I raised my hand and, you know, if did you get, you know, people would say, you know, and I raised my hand. I'm like, oh, I got pastors. One of them in the professor's like, well, you can teach children Sunday school. I was like, what? I've taught children Sunday school at my church as a teenager before, but that is not my gift. There's other people that are very gifted to teach little children. And why would I do children a disservice by being their Sunday school teacher? And I always felt like I could hold my own in classes with guys. I know that sounds funny, but that was like the culture. I'm like, I think I could talk just as well, do just as well. And you're telling me I can't enter, not necessarily that I wanted to be a pastor, but you're just saying I could just teach Sunday school class.
Yeah.
It's insulting to the children and to me because that's not my gift.
Is this a predominantly white school too?
Yeah. I mean, I used to joke, my friend Pablo Paul is like there was one Puerto Rican or other Puerto Rican or Hispanic. There were two of us. We could see each other in the cafeteria. And then, some African Americans, there's more now, but not very many. And the thing is, like, I'm white passing now. Like, my brothers are not. My older brother is not. But my culture was very, because abuelita was at home, we spoke Spanish, blah, blah, blah. It was like I didn't grow up in like white culture. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And so do you feel like you passed there or like, was that an issue?
Oh, I mean, I probably passed as far as like my skin color, you know, it's still a little bit, you know, I feel like I get lighter as the years go on. I've been in the snow and ice, you know, but, you know, people would ask me if I was Italian or like sometimes from other places, or I would always get like, where are you from?
Yeah.
I don't get that so much anymore. But when I was in college, I was discriminated against like because of the color of my skin. But I ran into a lot of cultural issues, I think. Like there's some jokes I just don't get. Like I need people to explain to me, like, why is that funny? Because I'm like, or, you know, or my husband, I'm like, can you please tell me the punchline here? So.
They're usually not that funny if it helps. You're probably not missing out on much, if I can imagine. Well, so, I mean, I think that's all a really good backdrop for us getting into the book. You know, you talked a lot about the 2016 election. I think that not only the election, but like the campaign leading up to that, I felt like I had a good grip on, you know, okay, there. I get that most evangelicals are Republican, they lean right, and but they're not going to just go easy for any kind of power that comes along. And then during that campaign, I saw that that was not the case. for many of them. And I love that you mentioned, you know, like people who you grew up like listening to them on the radio, or, you know, maybe they had like best-selling books in the Christian bookstore or something like that, that were endorsing then candidate Trump. And it was like, it was, and oftentimes like enthusiastically supporting, not just like, ah, this is the best of two bad options, but enthusiastically supporting. And it was, I don't know how you felt about it, but just incredibly like demoralizing to see people who had been teaching, you know, ostensibly the gospel for years, suddenly enthusiastically supporting this guy whose life just looked nothing like Jesus, and most of his policies looked nothing like Jesus either.
Yeah. I guess I can say this, to be honest, I felt very betrayed by people, very thinking that you will sell out for anything just to get power. You will sell Jesus out just to get power. And I guess I'll just be honest about that. So,
yeah. Were those people like people on the national stage, or are you thinking like people in your personal life that you knew?
Some national stage. I would say the national stage, you know, cause I'm really blessed to have friends that are writers and different denominations, even denominations. That have their leaders sell out. And so I don't think the leaders always represent the people in those areas. And people can dismiss me and just say, oh, you must be a Democrat or this, that. And I'm like, listen, I think the gospel transcends a Democrat and Republican politics. You know, they have no idea in other countries about what a Democrat and what a Republican is.
Yeah.
It's just all a mix. And so the gospel transcends that. And I've been to Washington, you know, protesting immigration policies in the Obama administration and the Republican administration. So don't try to get me on that just because I think people have sold out. And I would tell them this in person if they asked me, you know, I was like, you're selling out for money and power and just trying to throw righteousness or something on it, cloak it with Christianity. And I just can't have it.
So that's why, you know, the book is so important. And, you know, like I said, the title is The Way Up is Down, Becoming Yourself by Forgetting Yourself. And so the message is all about, you know, laying down our lives for each other. And you mentioned, you know, not clinging to our rights. And that's a message that's really, in the last several years, resonated with me. But I also thought, boy, I don't know like how that lands and how that's implemented with someone who's been historically marginalized. So like for me as a white guy, middle-class white guy, the message of the way up is down and giving up my rights and laying down my life for my neighbor, like that's, there's novelty to that because that's not the message that I'm normally given. But for so many people of color and often women, lay down your life for everybody else is the message that society has been telling them. And so I want to know from you, like what, when that message is framed in the kingdom, like what does that look like for you?
Well, you know, I think it looks like the way of Jesus, right? Because Jesus was, he had unimaginable wealth and worship and he laid down his life and he was born in poverty and he still laid his life down for disciples in ministry. I mean, if he wanted to get the accolades of the elite and the religious elite, he wouldn't have done things like talk to the woman at the well, hang around with, you know, Mary, Martha, and their brother. And so I just think about Jesus's life, how he gave up his life all the time. And for someone like me, right, it's comes, you know, personal things, right? I have a certain amount of money. What do I do with my money? Do I spend it on myself? I could, but you know, like the early church says, like, if you have a jacket hanging in your closet and you know that someone needs it, your brother's or the clothes. I'm looking, you know, I'm in my room recording this, and I can see my clothes. If someone needs it, that should be theirs. Because I can easily replace it now. I mean, I'm not in the poverty that I was. But even I've seen very poor people be extremely generous. And on a personal level, not like Dallas Willard said, not having to have the last word in an argument with my husband just to stick it to him. You know, on social media, not sticking it to people. I lay down my life, especially when I'm, I always say raked over, you know, because of a view that I have. Like some of the views that I mentioned. And I mean, I'm sometimes want to strike back, and I don't, it doesn't mean I don't defend myself, you know, but I'm like, is this really worth it? Am I gonna, one way I lay down my life is by not engaging in violent and I would say culture of death language on social media or in person. Like the, you know, I'm talking, we've been talking about the Christians that have done an about face. If I dehumanize them, then I'm guilty of the same thing. It's like, yes. You know, the oppressed can become oppressors because we could just do the same thing back to the people that have mistreated us. And we don't want to do that. I think loving and laying down your life doesn't mean like, I don't say women should be treated as equals, and that it doesn't mean you don't speak up for rights. But, and it does, and I mean, I'm sure you and a lot of listeners fight for the rights of the oppressed. You just don't lay down. I mean, even Jesus called Herod a fox, but it's how we engage. It's, and I'm not talking about in an emotionally unhealthy, abusive way, in a toxic way, but you know, even my kids, you know, my daughter, mommy, can you do X, Y, and Z when I would rather be doing something else, you know, for the 1,000th time. I mean, that's good practice in laying down your life. It's listening to people that annoy you, right? And not dehumanizing them. I mean, I think in 1,000 different ways we can lay down our lives instead of being completely self-absorbed, like, and trying to get accolades and position and status either in the church or where we're at. It's listening to, you know, you hear people say, I've heard this said, and I think it too. You can tell who someone is by how they treat the lowest person. I mean, that was Jesus, like in a company or in a house, how you treat the lowest people in your society.
So. Yeah. I think there's a temptation for everyone to just not engage because it's hard and because it's costly, you know, specifically for standing up for the rights of the oppressed in America right now. Like, we will lose friends, we'll lose family, and it's just hard to look injustice in the face sometimes because it's painful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
So let's talk. I want to talk about something that you're actually doing to put your feet to this message, which is a campaign that you're a part of, drawing attention to what's going on in the border right now. So I don't know much about it, but I want to hear all the details and what's going on.
Yeah. So 2 years ago, myself, Michelle Warren, Nikki Tomasito, from Evangelicals for Social Action, and a bunch, we saw the zero tolerance policy happening. You know, the administration said, we're going to separate families at the border as a deterrent to having immigration come into the country. And it's just, as far as the like Latino, Latina, Latins, and it's also other immigrants, right? There's so many Muslim bans, all sorts of bans. But there is a fury directed towards people from south of the American border, being scapegoated, being used for political, lives used for political gain. See what we did? We kept them out of the country, even though businesses want them as workers. And it's just a big, huge hypocritical thing. And a lot of them, I mean, very intelligent people. Some are doctors. They can't become a doctor in our country because their transcripts don't transfer. But basically, to be honest, what we've done to them is demonic. I've talked to people, asylum seekers in person. I've heard of what's happened to them at the border and what has happened to their children. And so 2 years ago, there was a large outcry, and I started the Not Without My Child campaign. We got over 3,000 Christian women and some guys on board to sign a letter to Jeff Sessions to say to end this. And so I went to Washington, D.C. with other people, other women, and then also there were women of Muslim women, Jewish women, you know, Hindu, all sorts. We all stood in front of the Customs and Borders Patrol and demanded that they end this. That was on Tuesday, June 19th, 2018. The next day, President Trump signed an order to stop that policy. I think when they saw evangelical women or evangelical adjacent women there, they're like, uh-oh, you know, this is our base. and so it was a huge outcry. And I think that was just the straw that broke the camel's back. Us all showing up in Washington, D.C. with a letters and our outcry. We got a lot of coverage on that. And so back then I said, this is just the beginning, because first this policy, but they're going to continue to oppress and torment. And I actually feel like we're acting as the United States, like Pharaoh did to the children, the Hebrews, and that's what we're doing to the Latino. It's like a kind of genocide and torture, the way that we're treating people, the deaths that occur in our detention centers, and people are escaping poverty and violence and lots of, you know, drug cartels, and they would take this chance to come to the United States because it's so bad where they live that they're willing to come to the U.S. And then when they get here, I mean, we've kicked everyone almost out of the country and over the border into Juarez and now into Honduras. So there's not as many in detentions, not because there's not people, it's because we've kicked them out of the country. We don't let them wait for asylum here, which is not how it used to be. If you applied for asylum, you would wait here in the United States until your asylum hearing. And so under the COVID-19 virus and pandemic, the Trump administration is giving families this new choice. Either let go of custody of your child and let them get out of the detention and away from COVID, or stay in detention indefinitely and, you know, reap, you know, the consequences of getting COVID. So they're like, do I put my child at risk here in the detention center and have them with me, but we could die, or they could get sick and not get help? Or do I let them free to the state, never to know what happens to them? And so that's the choice the administration's given them. So they're trying to separate families again. So friend Gina Thomas, Michelle Warren, Nikki, Hannah Vicker Howe, and Christina Ford, we're all relaunching this coming week to say, hey, we're going to have to step up again. We're going to have to cry out again to get this family separation stopped. And we're not the only ones doing. There's all sorts of agencies and people crying out, but it's kind of hard to notice with everything happening with the pandemic.
Wow. So if parents do give up their children, is that a permanent thing, or is it, do the kids go into foster care? Would the kids actually be adopted, or is that unclear, as many things are in these situations?
I mean, they would be giving up, probably go to foster care, but you never know if you'll see your child again, right? It's like, you know, they're obviously parents want what's best for their children, but I mean, I'm not there. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't get into these detention centers, but they've seen what's happened in the past. I mean, it's almost like if it were me, you know, I'm like, I'm going to keep my child and stay in detention rather than give up my child and never see him again. But I don't know what the parents are thinking, but that's basically what happens. You have no guarantee you'll see them again because they've lost track of so many, right? What happened to the children? They haven't reunited all those children and families.
I still hear from people when I speak out about this, I still hear from people that this is nothing new, that the previous administration did this as well, which is not true. From the research I've done, that there may have been some exceptions where parents and children were separated, but obviously there was never a zero tolerance policy before the Trump administration. And then even after the zero tolerance policy was canceled, there were still these, seemed to me, massive loopholes where it was still occurring in certain circumstances. And now, although, again, it's not exactly zero tolerance, they're finding this way to basically blackmail parents into separating with their children.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, Shane, it is methodical. I think Stephen Miller's part of it. I think there's white supremacy involved, and that the, you know, the people from south of the border are scapegoats. But we have a history, you know, the indigenous people, Japanese, African American, I mean, even the Irish, we have a history of scapegoating people and torturing traumatizing, murdering them, and we're doing that, but we use legal lingo to do it. And you're right. The previous administration, I mean, Obama was the deporter in chief, but that's changed, I would say now. So I'm not saying that. And I went to Washington to speak about that, to stop that. But this is a cruelty that has been unseen. Cruelty. And I just think it has to do with the people making these policies. And I mean, it's like, I feel like it's Herod killing, you know, even in the New Testament, Herod did what Pharaoh did, killing kids under 2 years old. It's basically state ordered destruction and death. It's a culture of death. It's not the culture of life or pro-life.
So what can people do? You have this campaign to get the message out on social media with hashtags and things. Is there a website people can go to participate, to know, like, get the details?
Yeah, we're going to put this up. At the time of this recording, you know, because we obviously have day jobs and other things. I can send it to you, but you'll see Don't Look Away, which has been a hashtag that people have been using, and For Every Child on Twitter. We're going to send out a letter that we're going to send to, the Senate and different places, Secretary Wolf, and call for an end to it. And that's going to be launched here very soon. So if a listener is interested, look for Every Child and Don't Look Away hashtags on social media. We'll put stuff on Instagram too. And we'll direct them to a website. We actually do not have it up in this moment, but it will be here in the next week.
Okay. And when is there specific dates that this campaign is running?
Yeah. June 14th through 2020 through the June 20th, 2020. And maybe into June 22nd, 2020. But this is ongoing human rights abuses. But we're going to, as far as the push for asking to stop trying to separate families under the COVID crisis, those are the dates.
Okay, cool. So you and I are sitting here recording this on June 12th. And so I may actually rush this and try to get this interview out today because that campaign starts on Sunday. So for people listening, unless you're far out in the future, it's probably now as you're listening. So, go check that out, June 14th through 22nd. And like you said, this is ongoing. So I would assume people should use that hashtag after that. Just a specific push that week. So,
yeah, I just say, keep your eyes open to what is happening under the cover of COVID, what human rights abuses, not just to them. We've seen many, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, Marlena, I'm so glad I got to talk with you. Been reading your work for such a long time. So it's such a delight to be able to sit down and talk with you.
Thank you. It's been quite a blessing for me. Thank you, Shane.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron.
Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care.
Yeah.